To begin our discussion on this topic, we can recollect an anecdote from the life of Mullah Nazaruddin Hujja, the Turkish satirist, the Turkish Qazi, a judge who also happened to be a mullah. Many interesting, very witty stories are found in his life. And one of them relates to the many aspects of any issue that we consider. So the mullah was appointed a judge to his village, something like a sarpanch. And the first case comes before him for his trial and verdict. Two parties contesting for something. And the first party presents the case thoroughly, makes his points, arguments, presents the facts. The mullah nods in agreement and says, "You are right, you are right." Now the second party begins to present his version of the issue, his facts, his arguments, and makes his appeal. Interestingly, the mullah listens to him and says, "You are right, you are right." Now the two parties, as well as the people who have congregated there, are all confused. The mullah is supposed to give a verdict for one party and against another. How can both of them be right? So they say, "Mullah, how can it be right? Both have diametrically opposite claims. Both have opposite points that they are making. How can both of them be right? One of them must be wrong, isn't it?" And Mullah says, "You are also right. You are also right." So the story ends there without any conclusion. The conclusion is left to the listener, the reader. But it gives an insight into how there are multiple aspects of the same issue that we consider. Now look at the number of religions, number of schools of thought, philosophies, science contesting with religion, religion contesting within itself, the many strands of science which don't agree with one another. They're all contesting, and each of them say different things, make different claims, lead to different consequences. In the midst of all this, the common man is the casualty. As it says in ISIS Unveiled, there is a guerrilla warfare going on between titanic forces, and the casualty is human conscience, human understanding, and the common man's ability to lead a meaningful life. Contradiction in scriptures and religious conflict is so common, not just in our country, across the world. Conflicting ideologies clashing with one another, leading to bloodletting. And how many wars have been fought in the name of religion, in the name of God? Unimaginable horrors have been unleashed on humankind. But if you take even one scripture, hundreds of interpretations, and interpretations not just varying in their minor details, but diametrically opposing interpretation of the same scripture. One famous example is the life of Mohandas Gandhi, Mahatma Gandhi, whose every action was inspired, rooted in Bhagavad Gita. Everything he did, he traced it back to influence of the Bhagavad Gita. And the one who assassinated him, the one who killed him, quote say, he also claims to be inspired by Bhagavad Gita. How do you explain this? One person, his ideology, his understanding, the diametrically opposite person and his ideology, both being inspired by the same book. Another fact is that we can notice among ourselves, we examine our mind, is everything that we read, everything that we hear is immediately colored, tinted, biased by our likes and dislikes. We take in the sense mentally take, only what we like from any experiences that we go through. It is as if at the very boundaries of our perception, at the very fences of our perception, we have placed a certain kind of lens which will filter out anything that we don't want, that we don't like, and bring in only what we like, what will assert and further strengthen the beliefs that we hold, and surgically remove everything else that we that clashes with our beliefs. And it's a observation made by Mr. Judge, if I'm not wrong, that students of theosophy naturally and obviously without any question are not free from this. For a long while they would have studied theosophy, or what we call as reading theosophy maybe, but the fundamental outlook of life still remains the same. The person may be a Hindu born with certain ideas of life which he has derived from his parents. That fundamental ideas remain the same, only the terminology changes. We try to retrofit theosophical terminologies into the basic beliefs that we hold without disturbing those basic beliefs. So, in the ancient ashram system, the disciple, the student, was from a very young age put through great mental and moral training to have an absolutely open mind. The ability to examine fundamental ideas of life and have a completely open mind towards what he studies. Now, going back to the religious conflicts that we find, especially in a country like ours, which is so diverse, there is no monoculture in our country. It is not that there are no examples of harmonious coexistence. Millions and millions of examples. It doesn't come out in public as often, but coexistence is a very foundation of this country, very truth of this country. A few years ago, we came across one Delhi couple, Muslim couple, Mohammed Shahnawaz Sahir. He and his wife adopted Hindu orphans and decided to bring them up strictly along Hindu lines. Bring them up as Hindus. They were named as Ayush and Prarthana, and continue to remain as Hindus. Such examples there are many in this country. We all know about the Ayyappa temple, and many of us may not know that at the beginning of the Ayyappa pilgrimage, all the devotees visit a particular masjid. The masjid belonging to Vavar Swami. Vavar was a warrior who came from Arab country. And the legend says it that Ayyappa himself instructed the king of Pandal Desham to build a mosque for Vavar at the Kottayam, in the Kottayam district. In fact, there is a shrine very next to Ayyappa temple to honor Vavar Swami, Vavar. The other thing we may not know is years before the Babri verdict came recently, years before, Muslims of East Champaran, Bihar, donated 50 acres of land to build the world's largest Hindu temple, larger than Angkor Wat, running to many acres. So Muslims donated 50 acres of land, that's about 250 acres or so. 50 acres came from Muslim families. Nearly 36 Muslim families came together and donated land to build a Hindu temple. I mean, we can go on and not still. That's on we can go about how we have coexisted with conflicting, seemingly conflicting ideologies. But at the same time, it is not that there is no conflict. Within a particular community itself, within a particular religion itself, there is so much of conflict and so much of clash. I remember one employee in an organization that the speaker worked earlier. There were two Christians, both of them belonged to different denominations of Christianity, and one of them would badmouth the denomination of the other Christian. And that would rile up this lady, and she would, gossip against him and, make certain accusations against his denomination, and so on and so forth. All belonging to the same religion, but when it comes to the details, then there is conflict. In all religions, we'll take a few examples. Some of them are quite humorous and very enjoyable in a way. There was one Trivikrama Pandita, an Advaita scholar, who lost to Madhvacharya, the Dvaitin, in a debate and became converted into Dvaitism. And he went to great lengths, to great pains, to prove that Shankaracharya was a demon. Wrote a long polemical book to prove how Shankaracharya was a demon, actually, in reality. So, in response to that, a modern Advaita scholar wrote a still longer book to show how it was not Shankaracharya who was a demon, but in reality it was Madhvacharya who was a demon and not Shankaracharya. And in response to that, a contemporary Advaita scholar wrote another book to, we can know what he would have written, what his claims would be. And another article came in the newspaper some time ago, where the author had collated some insults that are found in Sanskrit texts, ancient Sanskrit texts, of one sect insulting the intelligence of the authors of the other sect. Some of them are, oh, he's so delicate minded, the triumph of ineptitude, this is all but juvenile squabbling, such a childish prattle does not merit a response, gosh, how dreadfully deluded. And a favorite one of the author was, there is no point arguing with someone who is clearly drunk. So the social media wars that we find are not new. It is, such kind of name calling has been happening for a long time in this country. And among Buddhists, when Mahayana sect gave out their teachings, they were called as Adhammavadins by Hinayana. So in response to that, the Mahayana called Hinayana as Papa Bhikkhus. Appaya Dikshita was a 16th century brilliant scholar of the Advaita school of thought, and he wrote two books which you know ruffled the feathers of Dvaitins, because he named them as first book Madhava Mata Vidvamshana, that is complete destruction of Madhava's Mata, Madhava's religion. And second one was even more controversial. He said Madhava Tantra Mukamardana, which means clobbering the face of Madhava's philosophy. So it's not like Dvaitas took it lying down, because Vijayendra Tirtha wrote a book in response to Appaya Dikshita and named it as Appaya Kapola Chapetika, which means a tight slap on the face of Appaya Dikshita. So such conflicts we find in science, sociology, politics. It is as if the human mind is unable to grasp reality in its entirety, but by force has to fragment it and hold on to one small shadow of truth, hold on to a pitcher of water, a mug of water, and call it the ocean itself. So the very fact that there are these various dimensions, various aspects, requires tolerance. But what do we mean by tolerance? Does tolerance mean that is it a insipid, spineless, indecisive agreement, passive agreement with everything? Certainly not. That would be called, as in the words of Robert Crosby, namby-pambyism. He says indiscriminate acceptance of everything and everyone is not good. The attitude of namby-pambyism is a pseudo-tolerance. Carried to its legitimate conclusion, this false idea of brotherhood in quotes, would signify that sin, sorrow, suffering, error, all religions, all philosophies, are all right. That everybody is doing the best he can and the best he knows how to do, and cannot do anything different, and all are steps of learning. This kind of spineless acceptance. So this is not true tolerance. In fact, the word tolerance itself has a certain negative connotation. Come to think of it, what do we tolerate? Do we tolerate good people? Do we tolerate happiness? Do we tolerate pleasure? We tolerate only painful things. So when we say religious tolerance, of course, it comes from this kind of conflict comes from the defects of English language. Nevertheless, we should not look for a kind of tolerance where you are tolerating the other person because you have no other option. That is not the tolerance that we are looking at. We are looking at something higher, like the apex of the triangle, which will harmonize the conflicts and bring about a synthesis. That kind of higher harmony is what we are looking for. While we are discussing the subject of religion and the many aspects of the different religion, how religions approach truth, the different paths that religions take to approach the same truth, the different ways of expressions of each religion. While we are discussing all this, we have to, address the issue of extremism. And extremism does not belong to Islam only, which is a very wrong, mistaken propaganda that is there. Extremism is there in all religions. Wherever there are human beings who are defective, and which human being is not defective? All of us are defective. All of us have weaknesses. That human being takes anything that is given and transforms it into a source of conflict. Human beings are very good at this. We have perfected that art of conflict. So we have to address the question of religious extremism. Okay, we want to now evaluate a particular religion because it is extremist in its basis, and we want to, you know, critique it, criticize it. Okay, by all means, let's go ahead and do that. Let's examine other religion, the religion that we don't belong to, and critique it. But let us do this evaluation within a certain logical matrix. And what's the matrix in which we evaluate a religion? Whatever lens with which you are looking at the other religion, the same lens of evaluation must be used for your own religion also. Can we do that? If we do that, good. Let's go ahead and do it. Let's go ahead and evaluate the other's religion. In fact, not only the same lens of evaluation must be used to look at our own religion, the defects of our own religion, we have to be far more critical of our own religion for two reasons. Firstly, we have to be more critical because we are liable to overlook the mistakes and defects of our own religion due to personal bias. It is very easy to not see our defects, not see the defects of our own community, and therefore we tend to overlook them, and therefore we have to be far more critical, far more strict in our evaluation of our own religion. And secondly, the reason for being more critical is because we are born in that religion and in that community, we have a special duty towards our community and our religion to evaluate it rightly according to the rules of justice, equality, compassion, and cleanse it of all impurities that the religion that we belong to would have been infected with. It is very easy to see fault in others' religion. Garuda Purana says, the vile, look at the words it uses, the vile are ever prone to detect the faults of others, though they be small as mustard seeds, and persistently shut their eyes against their own, though they be as large as vilva fruit. Vilva fruit is beldhannu in Kannada. So such a big fruit is obstructing our own vision, and we go try to find fault in others' religion. And second point, when we point a finger, we all have heard this when we were children, you point a finger at others, four are pointing towards you. This is an absolute truth, absolute truth. When we are criticizing others, there are four things, fourfold, you know, mistakes that we are overlooking in our own self and our own community. And third and most important aspect in this is, you want to evaluate some other's religion, you must be very clear as to the motive with which we are, you know, embarking on such a journey of evaluation. Why are we doing that? Because if you wish to destroy something, if you wish to condemn something, let us be very clear, the laws of life, the unity of life is such that what we wish for others will come to us. The harm that we do for others will find a peculiar way to come and harm us, come and harm our community, come and harm our nation. This is a basic fact of life arising from the truth that we are all one, there is unity. So you may be a great scholar, knowledge of Prakrit and Sanskrit and Hebrew and so on, but life itself will debar you from reaching truth if our intention is not right, if our motive is not right. So look at the ancient method of critiquing other sects. There's so much to learn from it.
It seems many ancient great teachers and scholars used this method. It was a three-step method. First is you have to thoroughly acquaint yourself with all the propositions and ideas of the religion or the school of thought that you want to critique. It's called Purva Paksha. That is complete examination and clear representation, unbiased representation of the thing that you want to critique. It is only after you have achieved this understanding of the other that you go to Khandana. Khandana is not Kannada Khandana or Hindi Khandan, which is condemnation. That's not that. Sanskrit Khandana means critiquing it. That is analyzing it neutrally. Neutrally critique the other's system, and then not only you just don't stop there, you tell what is the right thing according to you then. That's called a Siddhanta, establishing your perspective about the issue. So Purva Paksha, Khandana, Siddhanta. This is seen as a kind of non-violent approach towards multiple schools of thought that are conflicting. When you want to make your proposition, you first better be acquainted with the propositions of other schools which you want to critique. And even in Indian jurisprudence, look at the way in which jurisprudence was built. There was Purva Paksha here also, which means the complaint. Complainant comes with a certain complaint, Purva Paksha. Then there is, you don't pass a verdict by hearing one side of the party. There is Uttara, the reply, the response to that complaint. Then comes Kriya, that is trial, investigation, honest investigation of the complaint as well as the Uttara. Finally comes Nirnaya, which is verdict. This framework we can keep in mind when we are evaluating other philosophies. And other point that comes to mind when discussing religious extremism is, from what framework are we examining religious extremism? Terrorism, extremism, fundamentalism. Without understanding, without having a broader view of soul evolution, without understanding the karmic complexities, the complex train of cause and effect, which result in circumstances of life, which result in happiness and sorrow, which result in oppression and liberation, without understanding the necessities of soul evolution and karmic complexities, how can we even pass any judgment on historical events which are taken out of context? The Persian poet says that he equates life to this strange situation where you open your eyes and there is a one sheet of paper. It contains a portion of the story. Now you don't know what book the page is torn from. You don't know what is the title of the book, who is the author, what are the previous pages, what happens subsequent pages. You know nothing about it. You don't know about the foreword. You don't know the storyline, nothing. You just have one sheet of paper torn from somewhere of the middle of the book. That's all you have. Now, understand life. You just have one paper, one sheet with some content in it. Can you build the whole story out of it? You are most liable to do mistakes. Similarly, is our understanding of historical events unless we take a comprehensive view of life. That comprehensive view of life is based on how we are all soul entities, how we are not temporary bodies, but we have been in bodies prior to this one. We have acted along various lines. Those karmic lines are present. Karmic energies are present. Collectively, we have done good things and bad things, and each of them will work out its consequence. We is from this broader understanding of soul evolution that historical events have to be analyzed. In our day-to-day dealings with interaction with people with differing ideologies opposed to ours, even here, it is not that resolution of conflicts and finding a harmonious common ground is not possible. It is not so at all. One can certainly find a common ground for having a good, working, happy relationship with even with people who have conflicting ideologies. And this is where the biggest contribution of Jaina Dharma comes, which Mahavira formalized, and it is explained with the story which we are all very well aware of, the six blind men and the elephant. All of them touch various parts of elephant. Some say, one of them touches the tail and says that reality, or rather elephant, is like a rope. Another touches the leg and says it is like a pillar. Another touches this thing and says it is like a spear, and so on and so forth. All of them are true, but conditionally true, because reality has multiple aspects. Every religion, every ideology, every science looks at one aspect or sub-aspect, and it is true within that framework. So anekantavada, eka means one, aneka means many, non-one or multiple, anekanta, anta means viewpoints. So anekantavada is a pluralistic view of life which says that everything has its right place within the context in which it functions. That philosophy, that religion, that ideology is right. But within the context of something else, this becomes false. And Gandhiji used to adopt this ideology, this kind of outlook towards his severest critics, severest opponents, those who wished death on him. He says in one place, it has been my experience that I am always true from my point of view, and I am often wrong from the point of view of my honest critics. I know that we are both right from our respective points of view, and this knowledge saves me from attributing motives to my opponents or critics. Look at how simply stated but deeply revolutionary this idea is. You are right from your point of view, I am right from my point of view, there is no cause for conflict. And this must be adopted by us, adopted by all honest seekers of truth. In every sense impression of ours, in everything that we see, hear, touch, taste, smell, we are influenced by our deeply hidden biases and likes and dislikes. His Holiness the Dalai Lama gives an example of how mind functions and changes your reality. Right? He gives the example of how on a day when your mood is good, you look at your wristwatch and say you admire it. Such a nice watch, so simply made. The manufacturer must have taken so much pains to manufacture this watch. It shows time so correctly all the time. You know, it is my favorite watch, and so on. So you are imputing your mood, your sentiments on the watch, on the object. Tomorrow you wake up with a bad mood due to some problem, and then you look at the watch and slap it and says, this damn watch does not show the time correctly. That foolish manufacturer, I don't know, he must have used some, you know, things he used to make the watch must have been of low quality, and so on and so forth. The watch is neither this nor that, but your mind and our likes and dislikes deeply influence our experience. Similarly, in our relationship with others, it is our biases, likes and dislikes, which we impute on others, ascribe motives to them. You know, he did not do this because of such and such a reason. She said this, or she did not speak up because of such and such a reason. He did not return my call because I had said something like this. All these conversations are all there only in our mind, are all reflections of our deluded thinking. Coming to open-minded inquiry, we find it in all religions. Every religion is based on this open-minded inquiry. We have all heard of Nasadiya Sukta. In fact, Bharat Ek Khoj, what we used to see in Doordarshan in the 80s, began with this title song from Rigveda called Nasadiya Sukta, where it says, you know, what was there before all this universe came into existence? Was this there? Was that there? Who knows what was there? Who knows what was there? The highest God knows it, or perchance even the highest God does not know it. This kind of open-minded inquiry is at the root of all religions. In the Buddhist scriptures, we find it, you know, prefaced by the words, thus have I heard. Evam maya shrutam, thus have I heard. That is, this is not my doctrine. This is what I have understood. This is what I have heard from my teacher. And HPB shows how when Pilate asked Jesus, what is truth? Jesus kept silent and never responded. And she goes on to say, though the master was silent about this profound question, the overzealous followers it has not stopped the overzealous followers from claiming to have monopoly over absolute truth itself. So, we have to develop this idea, or we have to develop this mental framework of keeping our minds open to others' opinion, others' religion, and examine our own mental grooves. These mental grooves or mental pathways that we have created, not only from this life, the samskaras that we have from past lives, all the karmic tendencies that we have, very strong in our mind, unknown, unsuspected biases. And it is on the basis of these that we live day and night, life after life, examining all our experiences and misunderstanding our experiences because of these mental grooves. How do we overcome these mental grooves? Take the case of Ramakrishna Paramahamsa. Some of you may know already that Ramakrishna, though born a Hindu and a Kali worshipper, he for many, many months converted himself into Islam. And conversion, not any external conversion, it was like you would not recognize that it was Ramakrishna Paramahamsa. Right from wearing the kind of clothes, leaving the beard and externals, to five times namaz and following every single rule that is there in the Islamic system, he followed it for months and savored the truth of Islam. He practically merged himself in Islam and savored the truth of Islam. Then came a phase in his life when he did the same thing with Christianity. He became a Christian. So he was like this typical bee which goes to many, many different kinds of flowers, colorful flowers, picking from it the honey that it holds. That open-minded inquiry and open-minded this thing we have to develop. How do we do it is seek those who have views opposite to yours. actively seek opposing views. Step number one. Step number two, when you seek them, for a moment, put aside your own views, your own ideas, your own beliefs, your own tendencies. Put it aside. Initially, it is difficult, but it's a practice which can be done. Put aside for a time being your own views. Temporarily adopt your opposing view thoroughly. Not just taking them in so that you can build arguments against it. That's not sincerity. Thoroughly adopt opposing views. And when you have adopted it, third step, examine the basis of that view. What is the foundation on which these views are built? Examine that basis. See the implication of having such a foundational idea and adopt what is good. Reject what is not good. By these four or five steps, in a single life, we will have gained the experiences of many lives. Because life is not just in the body, it's the mental experiences which makes all the difference. And by adopting this in all our, whether it is political opponents, different ideologies about economics and our own people at home, so many different ideas they have about, if you take six people and put a pot in the middle of them, there will be 36 ideas about that pot. So adopting and broadening our mind makes it capable of receiving truth. And this HPB most admirably did when she launched a magazine called The Lucifer, very controversial name, The Lucifer. And she says in her editorial remarks, what is the editorial policy of this magazine? In that magazine, it may surprise you, because we, at least this student has not come across any such any magazine which has such a kind of broad outlook. She would give space for writers whose views are not just divergent from theosophy, whose views are directly, diametrically opposed to theosophy. She would give space for them to write their views. Not only to those who are diametrically opposed to theosophy, but even those who insult, those who pass very slight remarks and caricature theosophy, even they would be welcome to contribute articles and present their view of truth. Agnostics, Christians, scientists, you name any of them, any sect, all of them were welcome, all of them were free to present their views, and HPB would make only very casual remarks about where theosophy differs from their understanding of it and from their perspective of truth. This kind of broadness is something very rare, something very rare. And the teacher says, unless you develop this kind of openness, all that you will see is only a reflection of your own likes and dislikes, reflections of your own face. You look into the allegory of the well, at the depths of which truth is hidden. She is drowning. She is hidden there. And we are all looking from the top of the well, trying to seek truth. And all that we see and admire and so happy about is our own reflections, not truth itself. So by having an open-minded inquiry into all the experiences of life, we may probably become capable of acquiring relative truth on earth. As a final point, she says that absolute truth, forget about it. There is no way you can acquire absolute truth on this earth at all. For obtaining absolute truth, you have to overcome your, paralyze your senses, entirely dismiss, negate your personal self and develop through rigorous training your higher spiritual faculties, which are unerring. Then on higher planes, there is some hope of perceiving truth in itself. Till then, till we reach that state, at least let us practice in our life, in our relationship with others, at home, with other communities, this kind of open-minded inquiry, open-mindedness, humility. Humility is the basis of knowledge. Humility and open-mindedness, that may prepare us for understanding relative truth at least. So we will stop here and 7 or 8 minutes, 6-7 minutes, we can take up more than any questions, response to these ideas and sharing of your experiences. That will be more appropriate.